Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, they have always called Atlantis the lost continent. And some say that it might have been rediscovered by the United States Navy in the late 1900s. And if that's true, just what are they doing with it? There is a new book out called Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. We're going to be talking with the author. He's been on Coast to Coast before, James McCanney, because there's lots of new information that we're going to talk with him about, including the possibility of ancient spacecraft from Atlantis. James McCanney, MS, that's Master of Science, is a physicist who has spent decades promoting his theoretical work showing that the solar system is ever-changing and is electrically active. Now, these theories have been confirmed with space probe data and prove that there are definite Earth effects resulting from our sun's electrical activity. We've talked with James about this before. He has openly opposed NASA's view that outer space is electrically neutral and has direct knowledge of what he calls NASA's lies. James was on the faculty of the physics and mathematics departments of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. His work was in theoretical celestial mechanics and plasma physics. And for those of us who might not know what the heck that is, these are the studies of planetary motion and electrified gases in outer space. Now, having presented his theories at the Los Alamos National Laboratories and the American Geophysical Union, James McCanney, who's the author of Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, has just completed a new work, called Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, and he is my guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, James. Welcome back.
George, thank you for inviting me back.
Well, you promised that I would get the very first copy of your book, and you delivered, my friend. Thank you so much.
I hope you like it.
I do. It was very good reading, and it shows the kind of homework and work that you have done. James, before we get into some of these theories, and I think some of them are just really out of this world, let's talk a little bit about Nikola Tesla, because it's important for people to really understand who he is, who he was, because that's going to lead up to some of the theories, some of the things that you write about in the book. Of course, he's dead now, died in New York City in 1943, and he was born, where was he born? In Austria, Hungary at that time, right around there?
Yugoslavia, I believe, and he did move around a bit, but then he did end up in the United States very shortly after that. And quite an interesting person, quite an intelligent person. One of the most amazing inventors, of course, of our modern times.
I mean, he just kept inventing things. He's had more than 700 patents in his career. And, of course, as most of us know, apparently after his death, his notes, his records were all confiscated by the government. And they took him away. And, you know, some of his theories are pretty profound. Some of the things that he has invented, telephone repeater, rotating magnetic field principle, alternating current systems, induction motors, alternating current power transmissions. He invented the Tesla coil transformer, wireless communications he's been involved in, the radio, fluorescent lights, and like I said, about 700 other. He was, no question about it, a genius, and he was born in 1856. Now, some of the things that he has created have had a bearing on some of the work that you have done, including this book, Atlantis to Tesla. And tell me why. Why Nikola Tesla?
Well, the entire situation here has to do with the fact that our solar system is electrically powered ultimately by the sun, but that translates into what I call local environmental batteries, and these I define in the new book. They're introduced in the first book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, and the situation is there are dozens of these around planet Earth and all of the planets. And what Tesla learned how to do was to tap into a couple of these local environmental batteries, one of them being the battery between the ground that we stand on, the Earth, and the ionosphere.
Mm-hmm.
which contains tremendous, tremendous amounts of stored energy. So that leads back into something that has not been understood fully up till, I guess, my work here with the electrical nature of the solar system. And that's what's allowed me to take a look back into history, into Atlantis, and see what they were really doing back then. And now it's becoming very clear. And, I, of course, after reading the book, you can see the train of thought that had to go into rediscovering all of this science.
There's an old organization that believes that Mr. Tesla might have come from another planet. Maybe his soul did. What do you think?
Well, I tell you, once you see, as a physicist, once you see the train of thought that goes into discovering, once those key elements are realized, and in science, just a second, excuse me,
sure.
In science, once you realize these key elements, then it's like crawling over the top of a mountain and seeing this vast plain before you. All of it is, it's just downhill from there.
You know, the book, The Day After Roswell, by Bill Burns and Philip Corso. Corso, at the time, prior to his death, said that Tesla had a death ray technology very similar to a device that might have been found aboard a crashed disk at Roswell. So maybe he did have some kind of extraterrestrial knowledge. Who knows, huh, James?
Well, it certainly is, and that is the kind of thing you would use. And there again, we go back into Atlantis and the ancient sciences, and you realize that there were certain elements that Tesla had as he was developing that were not there before, and one of them was the use of glass. Amazing, amazing material that we need in electronics to make a lot of the things that Tesla made. Without glass, without wire, without those basic properties of those materials and the ability to form them into vacuum tubes and, for example, deposit a thin layer of metal on a inside of a vacuum tube. These are the things that developed into our modern diodes and triodes and radio, components, which now, of course, are transistorized. And I might date myself a little bit here by saying that I, certainly learned all about tubes when I was gaining my physics mm-hmm. education. But once you realize the essentials there, then it's all downhill from there. All of these inventions come just falling out, literally, and that's what Tesla was doing.
Okay, now your book, of course, called Atlantis to Tesla. So there's obviously some relationship here between that lost continent and some of the work of Tesla. What's the tie-in there, James?
Well, the situation is Tesla, his father was a monk in Eastern Europe, and he worked, he had access to the Vatican records. And Tesla himself stated that it was through these records that he got his first exposure to the ancient technologies. So the real connection is that, for example, I believe that the burning of the library at Alexandria, there was a fire, but they didn't burn all the books. The good ones went to the Vatican.
Mm.
The ancient records that came down from ancient history, basically, many of them have survived and are intact, but including a much stronger version of the Old Testament, which is the Colburn Bible, is one of them.
Which has been suppressed, hasn't it?
Absolutely, and that is one of the groups that they've maintained the Old Testament in its original form. And what you realize from those old writings is, first of all, the devastation, the downfall of Atlantis and these other cultures that we know happened, the Great Flood, etc., were caused by large comets that came by Earth.
And just blasted into the ocean or even blasted into the land?
Well, no, they came by. It was action at a distance.
Okay, so they didn't even hit the planet.
They didn't even hit the planet. They came by, and this is the cause of mountain building. And associated with that were tremendous electrical discharges. And they saw these both between the comets and other planets. For example, Mars, every culture that hands down a legend to us talks about a comet attacking Mars, basically, and alleviating Mars of its oceans and atmosphere.
And again, without smashing into that planet.
Yeah, without hitting it at all. It went by, and these comets are amazingly powerful. They are electrical in nature. They're not a dirty snowball. That's one of the biggest myths on the planet, that comets are dirty snowballs.
Well, what do you think happened, James, to Atlantis? And then we're going to get into some of the technology that might have been there. But with this comet, kind of describe for me physically what happened here.
Well, the comet, the Earth changes, of course, I describe in my first book, but they start many times 12, 15 months before you even see anything.
But you're getting the effect of it, you're saying?
You're getting the effect.
Okay.
The sun is building up power just like our sun is right now. You have a barrage of comets coming in from that direction, just like we are right now seeing comets come in from the south in great numbers.
Right.
And as this object comes in, it brings this entourage of other objects. So many times it's not even one of the bigger objects in this entourage that affects Earth. It's one of the smaller ones. But basically, once one of these gets close enough to Earth to cause a gravitational impulse, then you get a gravitational wave riding through the surface, the mantle of the Earth, at probably 1,000 or 2,000 miles an hour. This is maybe a 60 to 600-foot land wave.
That's a pretty big wave.
And so, yeah, the things that happened are very explicit. You know, the volcanoes erupt, there are earthquakes, and the recovery of Earth after these events, some are far worse than the others.
So this is happening, you're saying, 10 years or so before the actual major catastrophe?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and you're starting to notice these, and the Hopi Indians talk about these seven layers of Earth changes, and you know, all of the ancient cultures talk about these things. The Maya, the ancient religions go into great detail about their association. Quetzalcoatl is the Mayan god, and the same with the Aztecs. It's all been handed down from the last great catastrophe. And Quetzalcoatl was the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus.
Okay, so though what happens, James, once you get into that 10-year period? Let's take it to time period zero now, that whatever is coming by causing the effects is now really close. What's happening? What's happening to Atlantis, for example?
Well, the one thing, and these legends have come out of Atlantis, is that they never saw it coming, and the reason is because the energy from the sun, the increased energy from the sun, causes a haze layer to develop around Earth. So you don't really see a lot, especially a comet, which is fuzzy and faint anyway in
yes.
the sky. But at any rate, so a lot of these incidents occur, and they never really see it coming. They just know that something's occurring. But anyway, the electrical conditions, the storms start to increase in number and in extent, and the winds become more common. Like right now, we're seeing
crazy weather patterns. Crazy.
Yes, absolutely crazy weather patterns. And this is my belief why they took the SOHO satellite offline. Just a side issue here, but because just recently, this last week, the World Meteorological Organization put out a statement that the world's weather is basically bonkers. Something, of course, I've been saying for a long time.
Yeah, well, that's true. So at least, as far as Atlantis is concerned, it obviously got bombarded with so much devastation that it sank, apparently.
Right.
What was going on the entire planet at the time? Everything? Was there catastrophe everywhere?
Yes. It's now, the one thing I want to be specific about is we don't know which catastrophe caused which downfalls. For example, there's indication that Atlantis could have been around as late as 3,600 years ago. or according to some of the Greek legends, it could have been 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So we really don't know, but basically...
Or 30,000 years ago.
Yeah, we just don't know. We know that a lot of our culture has fallen through to the races that have developed out of those old races. But with that said, the whole world is being affected. And I have a chapter in the new book which actually describes the situation on Atlantis during the fall, and my estimate is that the landmass rose about 600 meters and then was plunged downwards, literally dunking it under the ocean.
Almost instantaneously?
Overnight, as they say, overnight.
Oh, my.
And at the same time, you have, 15 volcanoes on Java and around that whole ring there of the South China Sea, going off and depositing tremendous layers of ash on that area. So, in a single night...
So they didn't have time to really prepare for any kind of evacuation. Maybe some people escaped, as we have heard through the ages, maybe somewhat to Egypt, somewhat to South America.
Right.
But by and large, that continent was doomed, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah, it went under in a single night, and the... there were survivors, of course, and one of those random things that who survives, but the entire continent literally was plunged under the ocean. And you can see in that area right now, that's another thing I talk about, is the old continent of Atlantis being discovered in the South China Sea.
Is that where you think Atlantis was?
Oh, there's no question about it.
Because, you know, Casey thought, or at least said, it was near the Bimini Islands.
Right.
But you say it's in the South China Sea.
Right, and the entrance was through the what we now call the Strait of Sunda, which is between Sumatra and Java, where the old ancient pillars of Hercules were.
Right. Was this a small continent or was it a large one?
It was large. It was, as they said in the legends, as large as Asia Minor, which was huge.
Oh, absolutely.
And so if you look at the South China Sea, it really went from Java north, east to the Philippines, west to Sumatra, and then north up into the peninsula that sticks down Thailand and Cambodia, Vietnam.
How far deep did this continent sink into the ocean?
Not very far. If you look at the South China Sea, it's very shallow. And it's still plagued with floating bogs of grass and everything that used to be there.
Well, don't you think it would be easy then for us to find whatever buildings they might have had on Atlantis?
Well, two things. One, they're buried in ash. And two, it's almost impossible to navigate that area, let alone do undersea type of... investigation.
Okay, so you said the volcanoes probably buried most of the artifacts before it sank.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and what wasn't buried then, there was a tremendous amount of volcanic activity in that area at that time, and basically the ash was... the legend is that when people went back in through the straits of the pillars of Hercules, which was Krakatoa and mm-hmm. its sister volcano, and the pillars were the huge plumes coming out of the volcanoes that guided the mariners into the entrance. But they said when they went in there, it was just floating bogs of grass and volcanic ash, and you couldn't get anywhere near the old continent.
Okay, and you say, though, that our U.S. Navy may have discovered Atlantis, huh?
Yes.
Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with the guest James McKinney. James, let's talk a little bit about your thoughts about the U.S. Navy somehow finding the lost continent of Atlantis. When do you say that occurred?
The late 90s, or possibly earlier, but I recount a situation in the book where I was on a website one night and I was looking for remote underwater video mm-hmm. technology is kind of a esoteric little subject I was researching at the time.
A little hobby.
Yeah, and for the purpose of looking at archaeological sites underwater. So this was expensive equipment that I was looking for. And there was a link, and I got into a URL, and I started backing off. You know how you take off a piece and at the end and back into the...
Mm-hmm.
I accidentally backed into what turned out to be a secured Navy website.
Oh, really?
And so I started, and I didn't know it at the time, or, I would have certainly been out of there, but...
Sure you would, James.
And I... But anyway, I noticed that they were, in fact, doing a lot of underwater video photography in the South China Sea. And at the time, I thought, now, what in the world would you look for there?
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, it became very clear that there was definitely some very high-level secret things that were going on there. They were finding there.
Do you think they were aware at the time that they might have stumbled across Atlantis?
I think so. I think so. And I think the effort was underway to actually locate the thing I point out in my book also, of course, is the search for archaeological treasures is not just limited to...
Oh, you still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is not just limited to... clay things that look nice on a museum shelf. Much of it is related to the ancient technologies which they know exist, including the ancient sciences. So definitely Atlantis would be a real prize in terms of the technologies that existed back then.
Do you think they're still there looking?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. Yeah. That they're still there looking.
I wonder what, if anything, they may have uncovered or found or pulled out.
I have no idea. I know also that Iraq recently, one of the untold stories of the Iraq War, the last one, the one that just occurred here,
mm-hmm.
was the search for archaeological treasures.
Sure.
Specifically, the archaeological references to ancient science.
The Sumerian texts.
Right. And there's word that there was the ancient city of Babylon has been discovered, including a city that actually was underneath it that nobody even knew about. So there's a great deal of interest, and I make the point, part of the subtitle of the book includes the secret societies, and these are the groups that seek this information more than... any other thing on Earth.
Well, James, let me ask you, what kind of technology might have been on that continent, on Atlantis? Spacecraft design, if any. What do you think they had? How advanced were they, anyway?
Well, the first inkling that I got that something was, they had some advanced technologies, was when I learned that they had glass. They had the very advanced glass and mirror-making techniques. And once you're at that point... then you know the properties of glass. They also clearly had metal, and at that point, now you can start to make containers, and we know from the development of electricity and the knowledge of electricity, say in the 1800s, when they were taking glass vials and they put two pieces of aluminum foil, you know, just simple experiments.
Uh-huh.
I mean, glass always was one of the primary elements that we needed to understand and experiment with electricity.
I'm beginning to see the tie-in with Tesla now.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And Tesla came at a time when glass and glass working was very available. So prior to that, you could have been in a place. The other key element of Atlantis being in the South China Sea and prior to the pole flip, was that if you take a globe, you look at the old North Pole, north of the state of Michigan, somewhere up in Canada, and then you look at the South Pole in the South Indian Ocean, and you do a rotation of the old equator, you find that Atlantis in the South China Sea was just a few degrees south of the equator. So it was right on the westward-moving electron central ion belt, basically,
mm-hmm.
that we call it an ion belt, but around the equator it moves westward and it's primarily electrons. And also, that area is extremely active electrically, so that even in the early days of our space program, NASA did not even want to fly over there, and if they did, they would shut down all radio communications. So it's very electrically attached to the, both the ionosphere and to outer space outside of the planet. So basically, here you have an area which is very electrically attached vertically, and you're living basically in a sea of energy that's flowing into the planet from that upper region of the atmosphere.
It's all over the place, right?
Yeah. On page 20 of my book, I show a picture of one of the volcanoes in the South China Sea, and they're very active up above electrically, much more so than other volcanoes around the world. But basically, it would be like living in Polynesia and not knowing how to swim. They were living in a sea of free energy. It was just coming out of the sky at them. So it's small wonder that they learned how to use this and harness it and basically do what Tesla eventually learned how to do, and that is to break down the vertical electric field and tap into that source of energy.
Do you think they used it to fly?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And that's why in the book I give the spacecraft design that I provide there, which is one of my, actually it was solidified by 1982, and I presented this at multiple gatherings of international scientists, and it includes a series of glass tubes where you run electrical currents through the glass tubes. The currents push against the local magnetic field, in this case the Earth's magnetic field, and it's a propulsion system.
A relatively simple one, too, I guess.
Yes, and the thing is, you do not expel any mass, so it's non-inertial, so to speak, in terms of physics. You don't have to carry a chemical that you heat up and blow out the back end of a rocket. So your mass is extremely low. You basically power this with nuclear power cells, and there again, you have a glass container for the nuclear power cells. So glass is your essential ingredient there. And basically, the Atlanteans needed to know how to use glass and metals in combination to make these tubes and everything else. My view is that our legends tell us that Atlantis existed for 10,000 years.
Now, where would they use these craft? In space or just merely around their continent?
Both. And the now, I want to talk a little bit about the statue of Poseidon, which was, legend has it, was in the very center of the five-ringed city, which was the capital of Atlantis, the major metropolitan area. And they were a colony, an empire, so they had colonies all over the world. But the main central location of Atlantis, the continent, was in the South China Sea. And the central capital, Atlantis, had a five-ringed city, and which was tiered in like plateaus going up to the center. And in the very center of the top plateau, the central ring, was a gigantic statue with five horses all made out of gold drawing a chariot with Poseidon. And his big spear was sticking up in the air. But what this also did, it was the Tesla connection.
It was an antenna.
It was an antenna to basically tap the electricity out of the vertical electric field of the Earth. So this was also their current source. Now, when you have this vertical current coming down, it creates quite a magnetic field. So you can ride that magnetic field up with your spacecraft, with the propulsion system that I just described. Once you get up there, now you have currents, which I've defined in the plasma discharge comet model, which also talks about the currents around Earth and connecting the other planets. So, for example, in the book I describe that as Mars comes into conjunction with Earth, which, of course, is going to happen here in May, and also it's alleged that the orbit of Mars in ancient times brought it much closer to Earth than it currently
does. You mean in August?
In whatever month that was, the conjunction that we're going to see in August.
Right. Now, this technology that they had apparently on Atlantis, was it also all around the world at that time? I mean, did other areas have the ability to tap into all this, or was Atlantis a very special continent all by itself?
it seems Atlantis was very special. The legend of Lemuria is that they were very much an earthy people and developed the mental side of human development, that they could, they had tremendous mental and telepathy type of powers, whereas the Atlanteans were more like maybe something like Western culture now, where we depend on technology as opposed to developing our mental state. But it's not known what was going on in Greece, because the ancient Egyptian priest cults who talked to Solon, who was the great the Greek emissary to the Egyptians, basically he told them that the Greeks, the pre-cataclysm Greeks and the Atlanteans were having a huge war, and the Greeks were starting to win. So it's, you know, the thing that I always see here is there seems to be a very bizarre combination of old technologies and very, what we would call, very superior technology.
All intertwined somehow.
Intertwined. They had chariots. They had horses. They had...
Well, look at the Star Wars movies. They have this unbelievable technology, James, but they're living like in caves, in blocks and stuff. When you look at that movie, the first thing you think about is, I wonder if that's what Atlantis looked like. They had this unbelievable technology, yet at the same time, they're living like cave dwellers.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so you know, there's such a difference. In fact, we have something like that today even. Just imagine our technology here, and you go to third world countries, and, you know, they're... 95% of the people on this planet are living hand to mouth in the dirt.
Yeah, almost. I mean, it's like a plane lands there, has no business being there, really, technically, and then takes off, and that's almost as if it seems that way with that kind of technology.
Right, right. And they did not have to. The thing that's interesting about all these technologies is you do not need to understand the physics behind them. You don't have to understand that there's a solar wind or a solar battery. You don't have to understand a lot of this to produce these technologies.
So you think that's what Tesla knew, that's what he was tapping into, a technology that was already on this planet thousands and thousands of years ago?
Yes, absolutely.
The technology that the Atlanteans had, where did they get it? Who taught it to them? Where did it come from?
Well, there again, with that time span and being where they were, it would be like I say, being a Polynesian and not knowing how to swim. You were just immersed in this field of electrical energy, and everywhere you turned, it was flowing out of the sky.
You don't think it really literally came from above, from extraterrestrials, and it was just handed to them?
Well, that's always a possibility, but just looking at the natural development, say, that we went through once, say, electrical tubes were developed for electronics.
You talk about secret societies and that this has got a lot to do with some of the investigations that are going on with Atlantis. Why don't you elaborate a little bit on that, James?
Well, the secret societies we know have existed. We know of some that are in existence, and there are others that we have hints of, but we don't really know a lot about them. But essentially, they go back to the very ancient cultures. For example, it is stated that Saddam Hussein is related somehow, bloodline, to ancient Babylon. You know, the place where he actually is.
Well, he thinks he was a reincarnated king. You know.
But I don't know about
maybe
this.
Maybe he is or was. Who knows?
Yeah. At least the we know the Egyptian priest cults were in existence when Solon went there back in the, 600 B.C. I forget what the date was.
Right.
But, in that time, those priest cults were in existence and were handing down information that eventually became what we call the Old Testament. So this information is being handed down, and it's not being done by sheep herders. These are very definitely the same thing with, for example, in the Western Hemisphere, the Mesoamerican cultures very definitely had numerical systems. They had calendars. They had higher forms of writing. They had language. They had all of these things that they did not develop on their own. These were handed down from pre-cataclysm days. We know from the words that are used.
Do you remember these? Because I remember when I was a kid, whenever people talked about Atlantis, they talked about a huge pyramid-type crystal. Do you remember that at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, is it possible that that thing was used as an energy source as well? And that sank too, but maybe it's still emanating some kind of electricity or power?
It very well could be. It very well could be, because at that area, the one thing that has to occur, any type of energy source, is it has to be replenished. And it certainly has a plentiful supply of energy right there, even to this day. So that very well could be that if you knew what to lock in on, you could actually see that energy coming out of that location.
There seems to be, though, a suppression of this kind of technology, and there's got to be a reason for it. Is it because it could be free and cheap, which is what Tesla was trying to work on, or is it so confidential and so powerful our government or governments don't want anyone to have it?
I can't speak for the cause of suppression of information. I find it amazing because I think that the people who are in charge have to understand that, that their life is made much more easy by the people who are, say, engineers and scientists, and they can only do their job if they're not out planting fields and harvesting crops.
Right.
There's a certain construction of society that has to exist for us to get to the point that we're at today. So if you try and destroy or limit that society, then you're only limiting yourself as a leader. So I don't understand the rationale. And additionally, to have a very diverse, successful culture, you need diversity. And I think we've learned that through previous cultures that tried to limit, say, an Aryan type of race or limited type of race, that they just don't work.
You've spent a lot of time talking about Velikovsky and some of the things that he has talked about. Do they continue to affect us today, James?
Oh, absolutely. I personally talk about the mountain building, for example, and plate tectonics as not being a cause of mountain building. That's just one small item. And the way our Earth is very active today is a direct result of a recent cataclysm on Earth.
Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, and James McCanney is our guest tonight, author of a new book called Atlantis to Tesla. James, these secret societies that may be on this planet seem to be desperately seeking some of these lost technologies. Why? What do they need it so badly for?
That I don't understand, other than it is possibly the thrill of the chase, that type of thing. I was always amazed when I would see artifacts sold to private individuals who'd pay a great deal of money, and of course in most countries it is illegal now, but they'd have to place them in a room where nobody else could see them. I don't understand this myself, but you have to understand too that we have security agencies whose job it is to understand anything that has to do with say security or technologies that might be used for warfare, and all of these come under that heading. So there's a couple issues here, but the secret societies, it is something more than just understanding technology. In fact, it's interesting that most of these societies don't have the technical expertise in their own membership to understand what they really mean or how to interpret or to do what, say, Tesla did.
But there seems to be an obsession, though, to try to get this technology before anybody else does, or to hide it, as you were saying. Is it that advanced, James, do you think, so much more than what we already have today?
I think there could be, yes, that there are some things or some tricks to what they were doing that I know with the propulsion system that I described here, there are certain aspects of that that I don't completely understand. And there's actually a Venturi type of effect, which I know is there, and but I don't understand how the electric currents mix with the magnetic fields to cause that to happen. In other words, at a certain point, you get a tenfold increase in lift off of the off the system. Whereas, you know, so something is going on there beyond what I understand. So definitely there are things that could be gained by reverse engineering or whatever you would call that.
Now, you, of course, have done some work, and you've written some of your knowledge in this book of what is called the Colbrin Connection. Why don't you explain that? What's Colbrin?
Well, the Colbrin Bible is a version of the Old Testament that has been kept in its purest form. It was kept by Joseph of Arimathea, who was Christ's uncle, and eventually it ended up in England and eventually was handed down through secret societies, and it is still kept today, and it's not a book that you will find in a library or can find any references to even. It found me in certain ways. There were people who actually, because they knew what I was working on, came and brought it to me and said, look at this, look at what you're talking about and compare it to this. And the things that it's very clear is that the, first of all, the catastrophe was very much caused by a comet. In fact, a pair of comets. It's very clear that the bigger comet, which was called the Destroyer, which some people, and I don't know this for sure, but it may be referring to Nibiru, the big comet of ancient history.
Sure.
But what's very clear, and we were talking about Velikovsky, what's very clear from this description is that it was the companion to the bigger comet that caused the damage to Earth. It wasn't the bigger one. And that's why I say these things come in an entourage, and you don't know which one is going to actually be the one that might affect you.
What would have happened had the bigger one gotten too close?
I don't think it would be that good,
No. Because
the smaller one did plenty of damage.
All by itself.
Right. But the Venus took probably 600 years as a large comet in the solar system before it ever encountered Earth. And that's after it came in. So I have a scenario I put together that probably about 4,200 years ago, almost 4,300 years ago now, this large object came in, bringing with it an entourage of smaller objects.
A whole handful of them, maybe more?
Oh, yes. And one of them was captured by Jupiter and thrown into a planar orbit, which was in the ecliptic, which 600 years later encountered Earth, and that was the comet that eventually became the planet Venus in Velikovsky's scenario. And the other comet was Hale-Bopp, which was flung out south of the solar system only to come back in the 1990s. And that was a huge comet, much larger. NASA never told us the real size of the nucleus, but the nucleus was probably the size of our moon at least.
Why don't you think they told us the real size? Did they know?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. They had watched that thing come in from the early 90s, I'm convinced. The real people on the top had seen that thing back in the early 90s, and of course it wasn't made public until the amateurs, Hale and Bopp, discovered it in, what, 95 or whatever.
So why do you think there was suppression there?
Because when Hale-Bopp was first discovered, it was on literally an almost direct collision course with Earth. And over that about 7-year, 8-year period, it slowed down due to the tail drag.
You mean that comet was heading right this way?
Yes, and it would have intersected us in the month of January almost within a million miles of Earth. So it was very close for a big comet like that. And so literally they just shut down the information. There's also an indication that they saw something much bigger farther behind coming in behind Hale-Bopp, possibly as much as 10 years beyond it, and that that is, in fact, still coming in as Hale-Bopp has already moved out of the solar system and is on its way out right now. But Hale-Bopp, when it first was discovered, was on a near-direct collision course with Earth. And as it slowed down, we moved ahead 3 months in our orbit and missed it by a long shot, by 110 million miles, something like that. So it really didn't come near us. It did affect our weather for that period of time and was the main cause for us overshooting the solar maximum in the year 2000.
So I'm concerned about the possibility of what might have been behind it. Of course, there have been cult groups that have thought it was a spaceship and things like that. And the fact that you say it was 10 years behind us puts it pretty close, does it not, to getting into our region?
I keep seeing these things come in from the south. There's an abnormality in the statistics of comets coming from the south all of a sudden. And that's one of my opinions, is that's one reason they took the SOHO satellite offline, is because many more were on their way, and it would become literally ridiculous, the number of comets coming out of the south.
So when you say they took it offline, maybe they just stopped releasing the information, or do you think they really took that satellite offline? They said that it's been hit by some bursts of solar flares, for example.
Yeah, and that the dish that sends the signal back to Earth is has a problem with its motor. That's basically what I heard. And so the data transmission to Earth is interrupted. So what we see now is very sparse occasional pictures and occasional solar wind data from the satellite. But the thing that they're not talking about is this past spring, NASA launched a much larger, much more sophisticated solar satellite. And we're not seeing anything from that, and we know that's up there. So it's not like they are without data. They're shutting down SOHO or whatever. Maybe there is a real problem with SOHO. But the situation is there is another bird up there with much greater capabilities, and we're not seeing anything from that, and nobody's talking about it.
Do you think, though, that they could point Hubble out that way and see something?
Oh, absolutely. Out in the south, and absolutely. That new big telescope that they put in about a year ago, it's about the size of your refrigerator, or a small refrigerator. That camera was designed to see local planetary-type objects. It was not for galactic or distant deep space work. It was for high detail on solar system objects.
Your thoughts are, James, that these comets that have gotten close to the planet since the beginning of time are probably what has probably caused more havoc than asteroids or anything else.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. A direct collision is very rare with the amount of things that are floating around now. But a near miss is much more probable when you have something big. And as in the case with Venus, it was a guaranteed near miss because it was in the plane of the planets. Its tail drag was causing its orbit to circularize and become smaller. And so as it was captured by Jupiter into the plane of the planets, we were guaranteed that sometime in the future, Earth was going to encounter that comet.
Now, you're not alone in these theories, are you?
Well, no. There's, I would say I was the person that introduced the theoretical structure of how comets work and how they are not dirty snowballs. And I believe a number of people have certainly are supporting this work.
What do you mean by dirty snowball?
Well, that the standard story for a comet is that they are dirty snowballs. And
What's a dirty snowball? You mean just full of dirt and all that stuff?
Yeah, it's a small, usually a few miles across,
okay,
rock with some snow on it. And, of course, with the space probes that have gone out to, for example, Deep Space One, which went to Comet Borealy,
mm-hmm.
found no ice, no water. It's a hot, dry rock.
Yeah, it looks like an asteroid.
Yeah, and the same, I just pulled an article today. I was looking at it from Comet Halley back in the mid-'80s, or what, 86, 87 time frame, when Giotto, the French spacecraft, went right by the nucleus, and they saw the same thing. It was a hot, black, dry rock.
Well, what causes the tail to light up?
It's a influx of material caused by an electric field that builds up around the comet nucleus.
And does that build up as it keeps going?
Yes, and it's drawn in by electrical forces into the nucleus. The situation is that most of it is water, from hydrogen and oxygen combining from the solar environment. But most of this in a small comet then blows away as neutrals. And this fools cometary scientists into thinking that is an ice ball that's deliquescing or sublimating in the solar wind. But the reality is the big comets can hold this material and they grow. And the bigger comets grow by a tremendous amount. That's why the big comets change their orbits radically. And the ancients called them the lawless ones.
Now, there are some astronomers, many of them, who think Velikovsky was nuts, that his theory is just literally doesn't hold water. But you stand by what he says, don't you?
Well, yeah, and the situation is that most astronomers today are in total denial of the facts. The facts are that comets are not dirty snowballs, and literally the theories that are being taught in astronomy textbooks are incorrect.
Well, if that's correct, what you just say, that that comets are not dirty snowballs, what does that then do to Velikovsky's theories and other theories about what comets are and their effect on this planet?
Well, basically, the astronomers were proving Velikovsky wrong, so to speak, with incorrect theories. And today, if you look at my theoretical work, it shows how comets become larger, and the very large ones can become planets or moons of the solar system, and that the solar system is growing by a method called capture. And so it's a constantly evolving solar system. It's not stagnant. It didn't form all at one time. In fact, that's one of the situations with the new comet model, which I call the plasma discharge comet model. Literally, there's a domino effect that occurs with the traditional theories. If comets aren't dirty snowballs and melting away and becoming bigger, then the planets didn't all form at one time, which is one of the cornerstones of modern astronomy. And then you have the electrical nature of the solar system. Modern astronomers say there is no electrical nature to the solar system. So there's a domino principle that occurs here in the traditional theories are literally replaced by an entire new set of theories. And that's what I've done. And it took a lot of homework to do this. You don't just do this overnight, and it's not something you do casually.
Velikovsky, of course, is dead now, but in the 50s started this controversy by his book, Worlds in Collision. How did he come up with these theories? What happened to him in order for him to, at least feel Venus was a comet and captured and things like that?
The first thing to understand is Velikovsky was not dealing with astronomy or science or anything remotely close to it. He was working with calendars. And his goal as an archaeologist, which basically a psychologist, archaeologist, and anthropologist, he was looking for a timeline in history with an event so major and on an Earth-wide scale that every culture in ancient times would recognize this, and then as a calendar restructuring, you would take that as a zero timeline. You could go forward and backwards in each country, which were, by the way, totally separate culturally at the time. If you look at, say, China and Tibet and versus the Mideast and other cultures, Mesoamerica, those cultures were totally unattached.
Was he a genius?
He was extremely intelligent, and the biggest problem is most people, astronomers who have actually read his books, most astronomers have not read his books, But most astronomers who read his books don't even understand what he's talking about or what he was doing.
And I heard that that book, Worlds in Collision, reached number one on the bestsellers list and then was banned from most academic institutions because it was too much of a scientific controversy.
It affected geology, biology, evolutionary biology, astronomy, physics, astrophysics. And so I found that the pecking order in most big universities is from the physics and astronomy departments on down. And there's kind of a thing where they very much force their beliefs on the other departments. So what you find today is that nobody can change. They're all locked into these structures, all assuming that the astronomy community is correct about, say, the dirty snowball theory and the other methods of formation of the solar system. So they all kind of fall in line. That's why you have something called plate tectonics, for example, that says that continents move sideways and then mountains are formed over long periods of time. But if you look at plate tectonics, if a planet formed like they said it formed billions of years ago and nothing has happened since, then as that planet cooled, the continents would dry and solidify and actually pull away from each other.
Right.
There's no force to push them sideways. I give an example in my first book. I call it the hammock example. And if you hang on a hammock and it's pulled tight, there you might weigh, say, 100 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
But the force on the strings, which are almost horizontal, are thousands of pounds.
Right.
And now do that in reverse. What kind of force would you have to push on vertically at the Earth's crust to make those continental plates move sideways? It's incredible.
And you're saying only a comet could do that.
And the only thing that's going to move those plates sideways is an inbound gravitational wave.
James, do you know if Velikovsky ever did any work into the Mayan calendar? You know, that very famous 2012 ending date.
He did a little bit, but not extensively. It was not his main forte. For example, he did more with the Eastern and other cultures. Although he did talk about Quetzalcoatl, and he realized that Quetzalcoatl was a god, a deity that represented Venus, and the legend that the heart of Quetzalcoatl eventually became the planet Venus, which was the nucleus of the comet.
And again, does this, and I want to get back to Tesla as well, because this is all connected, but does this have anything to do with what so many people thought might have been a planet X? Obviously, they were wrong. Nothing happened in the dates they said it would. But is this tied in with anything?
Well, the whole idea of the term Planet X is an astronomical term representing some object of planetary size that has not been named yet. So the term is very long been used. Just I think it got a tremendous amount of hype. And the thing I always point out is there was not one of these historically in terms of damaging Earth, and there are many of them. There are many objects associated with our solar system, and there's not an astronomer alive who can tell you honestly that they know for a fact that there are not large objects out there that we don't know about that could come in and affect the solar system.
At any time.
At any time, and we can see out a certain way, but that's it. And beyond that, there you just cannot see. The one that I'm looking at right now or anticipating might be coming from the south. Here's what happens when these objects break into the very, very outer solar capacitor, which is probably between 5 and 20 Pluto distances out. They very slowly start to discharge this capacitor, and they draw in material around them, so it actually shields them.
Everything seems to be electrical, James.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so this shielding cloud gets around them. And so with a telescope, even a good telescope like the Hubble, all you're going to see is a big hazy cloud, and it's going to slowly start moving in.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to see that object. You're not going to see like an orange planet or something like that, even from the earliest days. And that's like Hale-Bopp. When it was first discovered, it was already a big comet, way out there. So at any rate, the point is that there are many of these objects, and they don't all come into the inner solar system. They don't all crash into Earth. You know, I mean, many of them are floating around out there that will never come anywhere near us. But statistically, there are enough of them that eventually they do, and some of them are trapped into our solar system and become planets or cause damage to existing planets, including Earth. And our planet has all the markings, all the mountain building of this occurring many times.
You know, I find ironic is Tesla was alive, and I believe Velikovsky was alive, and I don't know what the overlap was, but they were on this planet together, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Velikovsky's first book literally came out in about 47. Well, you said Tesla died in 43.
Yeah.
But a lot of Velikovsky's work actually was done prior to that. When he was a young kid, his dad was the curator of the museum in Israel. So he grew up seeing all this stuff. He was not a kid that just crawled out of the woodwork someplace. He was educated in Russia. He had a PhD in psychology. He was educated under Freud. He knew multiple languages. He could read transcripts in ancient languages. This guy was quite the scholar, and it's really, really incredibly horrible what they did to him, not understanding even what he was writing about.
Well, you know, they could have simply said, we don't agree with your theories, but they destroyed the guy.
Oh, yeah, they did. They took him to the cleaners, and, you know, his name, and you just as some kind of total, they called him the lunatic fringe, you know, I mean, you know, pseudoscience, all these names came about because of Velikovsky.
See, if he were alive today with his theories, they wouldn't say that to him today. It would be dramatic. It would be different. They might say, we don't agree, but I don't think they'd indict the guy.
Well, he was so successful. And so when the astronomical community built their charge against him, which was led by Carl Sagan, that's why Sagan became famous, is because he organized the onslaught against Velikovsky. And they had to do this because Velikovsky was, even into the 70s, his books were selling, they were translated into 14 languages and selling all over the world, number one bestsellers. And so they had to dismiss this guy. And so when they did, the reverberations were so overdone that I don't think they realized how ridiculous the efforts were that the science community went through.
Well, do you believe, James, that there is a foretelling of another a catastrophe on this planet?
Well, clearly, you had a show the other night regarding the Fatima prophecy.
Yes.
And the third sealed prophecy, of course, is the one that everybody associates with a planetary disaster, a planetary scale disaster, and something coming in from outside, something big. And it has been regarded as something so horrible that they just don't want to release the information. Of course, we have the elite of the world building cave cities and storing up tremendous amounts of supplies. It seems that all the indicators are saying something big is going to happen.
What do you mean they're building cave cities?
Well, the cave cities, these large cave structures that are being cut under the United States in literally all over the world.
Is that low humming sound we hear all over the place?
Yeah, absolutely. There are people who are hearing these, like in Indiana or Virginia, and these are these big tunneling devices that can cut, you know, a 50-foot hole in the ground and just keep going.
They're building, what, cities for the elite or what?
That's what I know. I haven't gotten my invitation.
Nor have I.
And these are being built, underground to house people during a catastrophe. And I might add that that's not where I would want to be, even if I had an invitation.
Well, that would tell me one of two things. Either they're planning ahead or they know of a catastrophe.
That's something that's coming up. And the thing is, if you're under in a cave like that, those are going to fracture with the tremendous, if there's something passing by and we get these tremendous gravitational waves through the mantle of the Earth, that's nowhere to be. As I've always said, people have asked me, where would you want to be? And I would say, well, I would want to be out of the wind, et cetera, but I wouldn't want to be anywhere that I couldn't dig out with a small shovel in about 20 minutes.
Well, you know, James, with all the knowledge that the Atlanteans had, why couldn't they predict their own downfall?
It's hard to say. So little information has come down to us from them that it's really difficult to say. Maybe they knew, and it was like us. It was so devastating that there was just nothing they could do about it. And the other thing I think in the back of my mind, and of course you have to be real careful as a scientist saying things like this, is that some of them could have gotten off the planet and learned how to live out in space and simply went away.
Oh, that's possible. And you do believe, though, that that technology was out there then?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yes. And the method of movement would be riding along the electrical currents that flow through the solar system and between the planets. And so that's just something that, if you extend the logical progression, it could have led there.
They probably left Mars, came here, and probably said, here we go again, now we've got to leave.
Right. you just don't know where the progression went.
Well, how come we're not harnessing this kind of Tesla power and energy that those in Atlantis might have used? If it's out there, available, free, it's there every moment of every day.
Well, of course, Tesla had, when he built his first tower, I believe it was in New Jersey, and the story goes that he sold his generators and the grid system that he designed and built to Westinghouse, who was an individual, a rich individual,
mm-hmm.
and friend of his back in the, I forget, it was pre-1900 even, I believe.
Who apparently tabled the thing, didn't he?
And but the thing was, Tesla, in his contract with Westinghouse, requested that at certain times he could use all the power he would want off the grid for some of his experiments.
Okay. At no cost, probably, to him.
Right. And so what Westinghouse, he agreed, but he didn't understand that what Tesla was going to do was to use this power to crank up his Tesla tower, which was a big Tesla generator, AC high-voltage generator.
Mm-hmm.
And what that would do is break down the vertical electric field, and once he did that, he could cut the power that he was drawing to break down the vertical electric field, start drawing off of that vertical electric field, and then reverse that and put it back on the grid for free, which did not please Mr. Westinghouse, who had just paid all this money for the grid system.
Plus he had his own idea, right?
Right. So anyway, at that point, they came down and dismantled Tesla's tower.
How big was the tower?
We don't know. I mean, I don't have all the plans. Everything were destroyed or kept moved away somewhere.
Sure.
But it's a principle somewhat like I talk about comets, where the electrical size is much larger than the physical size. So, but it takes a lot of power to alter the dielectric component of the atmosphere, and that's basically what you're doing.
I mean, was the tower finished? Was it complete?
Well, apparently he was able to use it at least once, and at that point they realized what he was doing, and that's when they went out and shut him down. And of course, even at the end of his life, when, like you said, when he died, all of his inventions and records were confiscated. Who knows what that guy came up with in those final years, doodling on a piece of paper with with the information he had. So, but basically, the reason we're not using it today is because it is essentially prohibited. The other thing that I have to say that I've learned...
Yeah, 187 feet, by the way, is what they think.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they think that's how big it was.
187 feet. Now, I've not heard that before.
That's pretty big.
But that's big, but the electrical size would have been 50 miles electrically, you know, to reach up into the atmosphere and break down the dielectric component of the atmosphere and start drawing out of the ionosphere. And so that would have been the electrical size after he cranked up the generator part of the tower.
Well, let me tell you, he would have changed the face of, technology had he been allowed to continue or not run out of money or whatever happened to him.
Well, that's why I have a chapter in my book. It's called The Black Century. And it starts in 1900, and it talks about what should have been and what was in the 1900 to 2000. And where we should be today if Tesla would have been allowed to introduce his generator, where would the societies be today? And we would be doing much different things today because we'd be advanced beyond, you know, the crawling around the surface of the earth searching for oil and things like that. We would be advanced farther in the space age. Many things would be different.
You don't believe NASA, do you?
Not at all.
Richard C. Hoagland, subscribes to that same thought.
The situation is, and I talk about this a little bit sometimes, but there's definitely a secret space program, and NASA as an organization is what we see, but behind there's a much bigger organization. And we don't really know what they're doing.
A little hidden agenda there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the technologies and the guys that work in the aerospace industries, say the guys that work on chemical rockets, know that. They'll talk about, they know the road from them is a building where they know they're working on technologies that will replace rockets. Yet they're asked to get another couple percent out of a rocket booster. You know, and when they know for a fact that there are technologies down there that would easily replace rocket technology. So there's that going on. So definitely we have, I call it a three-tier scientific setup where you have the first tier you don't see. The second tier you get a little bit of an inkling of. It crosses over. But the third tier is what you see in universities, in NASA, the things that you actually see.
Have you ever come under fire because of your theories, which are pretty out there too, James?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, I would say that most people that might scrutinize my theories don't really read them or understand them or give them a proper airing at all, because clearly, people who are common people on the street, by the way, there's many university students who are following my work closely, and, you know, physicists and young science students.
I don't know if I want you to be right or wrong.
Well, it's not a matter of a vote or whatever. It's a matter of experimentation, and I've defined the experiments that'll prove my theories correct.
Are we getting, when these catastrophes occur on this planet, is this a recurring comet and a series of comets that come with it? Or are we talking about brand new ones all the time?
Both, actually. Apparently, from the ancient Egyptians and from every other culture that we know of, there is one that returns, and that's the one that everybody talks about.
That's the one they call Nibiru.
Nibiru and Murdoch and the Wormwood from the
Bible
and on. So there's apparently one big one out there that returns. And
so,
like I said the last time, I believe it was the Companion, not the big one that actually affected Earth.
Well, how far away is the Companion from the big one?
But there, it's like a mini solar system.
So it's close by.
Yes. Yeah, they're orbiting the big one. So as this thing moves in, it's like a solar system moving through our solar system.
Are you saying Hale-Bopp was the big one?
No.
Okay.
No, I think Hale-Bopp, originally they thought Hale-Bopp may have been the big one. But later they looked beyond and saw something even bigger coming in behind it.
Is that the big one?
And that, I think, is the big one.
All right, so if you said it was about 10 years behind, and Hale-Bopp was when, 97?
97-ish, yes.
So you're talking around 2007?
Possibly, yes.
Maybe sooner, maybe a little later?
Yes.
Maybe 2012?
Could be.
Think of it as your window on the world.
News Radio 610, WIOD.
Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with guest James McCanny. James, before we go to the many phone calls here, and they're lining up to talk with you, the catastrophes that have occurred on this planet, noted the flood in the Bible, the problems with Atlantis, the capturing perhaps of Venus as a comet. Does that all have the same thing to do with each other? I mean, is it all related?
Yes. The situation is with the large comets that there are many effects. And one of them is, of course, a comet, a large comet, like, for example, Hale-Bopp. We saw tremendous amounts of water influx into the nucleus over that six-year period. So water is a main component of a comet tail. So when one comes by and we get locked into one of these comet tails, the amount of water coming in is tremendous. One thing I like to point out is that many Earth storms that we see today develop with water that has to come in from outside, because there's simply no source of water as these storms develop, say, over the middle of a continent. And so there has to be an influx, and these are small amounts of water relative to, say, something like a Venus event where it rained for 40 days and 40 nights and literally caused an incredible flood. And then a pole shift where the poles are melting, that's a different kind of flood. So the effects are many. The rain of brimstone and fire, the meteor streams mixed with the hydrocarbons coming in that are burning as they come in, the hydrocarbons mm-hmm. like oil. And so all of these effects, the gravitational wave, the earthquakes, the volcanoes going off, I mean, this is not the place to be when something like that's going on, but it's nature's way of renewing, just like hurricanes, tornadoes, forest fires are all violent ways that nature uses to renew and recycle nature, in a sense, or this planet.
Why do you tie in this Kolbrin Bible with Atlantis and Tesla?
Because it's a link to the past, and it's one of the reasons is because for example, Christ gave the Sermon on the Mount, he goes back into the Kolbrin Bible, and the most asked questions that people have today, for example, when will this happen again? How should we prepare? All were addressed at the Sermon on the Mount. And all of these things came out of the ancient texts, which were in existence at that time. So there's a very much a link to the past. It also confirms the electrical nature of the solar system, the fact that comets can be very large and cause damage to Earth. And this confirms the solar model, which basically produces the electric fields, the local environmental batteries that we tap into for the Tesla technology. So it bridges. It's also the type of text that Tesla had access to when he was a kid through his father, to learn the basic fundamental principles that led him to all of his inventions.
You think this is what spearheaded his drive to, and this is an obsession for this kind of knowledge?
Absolutely. Yes, there was something that triggered it, and once he got turned in the right direction, his inventiveness and understanding, just there was no stopping him. So there's many reasons to link the Colburn Bible and secret documents just like it, which we know exist in, say, the basement of the Vatican, to the modern inventions and also back to the ancient science of Atlantis.
Well, why suppress it, though? I mean, there's what's in there that the world shouldn't know about?
I don't know. That would be understanding, but understanding that would be a key to understanding why we haven't progressed as a modern society in general. Why the leaders always want to keep things secret. Why is that?
Well, that's because they always want to put their thumb on us, James. Let's go to our calls. Wild Card Line, welcome to Coast. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, James. This is Dennis in Annapolis.
Welcome,
I have a question and a comment.
Okay. Fire away.
First, you were asking why the secret societies would want to pursue lost technologies so much. I was just thinking that it might be for one day when they eliminate the class system and have most of the working class enslaved, it will be a way of further separating themselves from the common man, so to speak, as you know, they think that they're elite. And second, you're talking about the tunneling and cave systems being built under the earth for people to live in.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if that was related to the Mount Weather that I've heard of, William Cooper talks about, where there's a parallel government, a secret government, and capacity to hold all kinds of people under a giant mountain.
Of course, and that was, as you know, James, the late William Cooper, who was shot in a gunfire battle with police.
Oh, okay.
Who
sure.
Had all kinds of different kinds of theories.
Right, and I don't know specifically all of the reasons for, say, the tunneling or the cities, but it just seems that that's not the kind of thing you would build if you were just worried about terrorism or other things. I mean, there's... this is long-term preparation, preparing for something long-term, not just a short-term situation which would involve, say, bioterrorism or other forms of terrorism that we know today. So something bigger is going on. And more than that, I don't claim to know, but it just seems very suspicious that all of this is going on.
You think it's worldwide?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
The bigger governments know exactly what's going on, don't they?
Yeah, we know Russia proclaimed a city. I don't remember how many hundreds of thousands it would hold in a mountain in Russia. So, yes, this is definitely worldwide.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Your turn. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, my name's John. I live in Portage, Michigan.
Sure,
John. James, my question is what do you think about the, you know, Planet X Nibiru crowd, like Nancy Leader and Mark Hazelwood, where, you know, Nancy Leader's openly said on her website that you're a government plant and that you're trying to destroy her idea?
Well, the people speak for themselves, I believe. I don't pick dates. Other people may pick dates. And, of course, we are still here after the May dating. So I see things as a scientist. I require myself scientific data. I don't post things that do not are not confirmed with some sort of scientific confirmation or citing, and so that's where I stand. Although I see things coming into the solar system, I don't put a date on arrival or that there's anything definitely there that's going to cause this. I'm looking very much myself. I have my own viewing programs, but have not seen anything yet. So I tend to work by myself. I post my own web page, and I don't get involved in internet chat groups, things like that. So I hopefully am trying to bring an element of sanity, both from all sides of this, and try and bring an element of science to the issue where you're not getting anything from NASA either. So,
and are you a loner in this, James? When you do your own work, are you by yourself, or do you have any help?
Pretty much by myself. I have much of my work was developed, of course, back in the late 70s, and much of what I'm doing now is writing things. For example, my current book, Atlantis to Tesla, much of that information was available to me back in the 80s.
Is this book out now?
Absolutely.
I know I have an advanced copy, but it is out now.
Huh? Oh, absolutely, yes.
Okay, very good. Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going? This is Merck from Riverside, James and Nori.
Hello, Merck.
I got a simple physics question and a complex Bible question.
Okay.
The physics question is this. All you have to do is you wrap a wire, like, in the shape of a cylinder, you know, and you wiggle a magnet through it, and you get electricity through the wire. That's crazy, illogical. I don't get it. Do you think that there's more stuff out there that we haven't, you know, put the diamond with the pearl and got some weird illogical thing that we, you know, haven't harnessed yet? That's the simple physics question. The complex Bible question.
Well, let's let them answer the simple question first.
I believe, yes, like I was saying with the propulsion system that I have detailed in the book, there are some, like I say, Venturi type of situations that involve probably complex equations between electrical currents and magnetic fields that I don't understand yet, which would increase the lift potential of this device tenfold. So absolutely, there are things out there we don't understand. So the answer is yes, we have a tremendous amount of understanding. You have to realize that most astrophysicists and space scientists today don't even believe there's an electric field out in outer space. So we have a long way to come just to get the basics down. What I do note is that as science progresses, mainstream science, daily, weekly, yearly, they are adopting my ideas one by one. And I'm not moving my theoretical structure at all. So slowly they are creeping basically into my theoretical structure.
That's what I kind of wanted to hear. Can I ask the other question?
Yeah, go sure. Go ahead.
A lot of Christians come up with a natural, phenomenal justifications for things that happen in the Bible, you know, significant things. But the thing that really freaked me out that probably bothers me the most is, what was creeping death? And what was the deal with the firstborn and the lamb's blood? I mean, what could possibly have been a past event that could be associated with something like that? I'll hang up and let you guys answer. Thank
okay,
you
that, you're not being a biblical scholar, James. I'm not sure you can handle that unless you want to.
I've wondered that myself. Also, it's interesting to note that the Mayans had a very similar, what would you call it, ceremony, where on the 57th year of their calendar cycle, when Venus was supposed to come around and destroy Earth again, because we know Venus had two encounters with Earth, according to the legends, and they were 57 years apart. But they would go into their huts, and they would actually paint, like, blood over the doors also. So I think it was more symbolic. But then again, the ancients claim that warded off, something, and they were spared. My view of it is that most people back then probably died. And,
for whatever reason and whatever cause, I guess.
Right. So I can't answer that question, though.
It does seem that the origins of religions and myths are very relative to cosmic events. You know, even though in the Bible, and even as you say, the Colburn Connection Bible, they talk about events that seem very religious, mystical, yet most of them, I think, might be able to be explained with natural space phenomenon. Don't you
right.
think?
Oh, absolutely. And we see that the Arawak Indians who worshipped the god Huracan, they lived in the East Antilles, where now the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, and they defined this god Huracan, who would come by in very similar situation, basically ravage their island and sometimes it was much worse than other times.
Sounds like that's how we got the word hurricane, huh?
That's where the word comes from, absolutely. And it's a very similar thing, and I think we're doing that now. We're personifying or giving godlike properties to natural occurrences, and what I'm trying to do is break through, and the public is picking this up by leaps and bounds, but to get the scientific community to admit that this is what's going on.
Everything they could not explain because they were just infants, I guess, in terms of knowledge, they gave it a very mystical effect when it was probably a natural occurrence.
Yes, and we're doing that today. We still do that.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, James, I have a rather testy theory that the universe itself is a burnt-out husk of highly involved, unpacific dimension that has a luxurious amount of life compared to our universe, and nothing but the extraterrestrials use it, and they have very limited uses, you know, that when they come here, you know, poking holes in it to observe mankind and move about our space-time continuum within our dimension, and just for reasons of observation, military studies, genetic reforming, and but that my theory is it's a very small amount of extraterrestrials' interests, and most life comes from another dimension that is mostly of life instead of void of life. What do you think of that theory?
Well, regarding things that we can't see, being a scientist, I only can measure and deal with things that we can see and touch and measure, unfortunately, and any proposition would, to become reality, would, you know, fall within that realm.
Okay. Was that it?
Well, that sounded good, but the way I look at it is, as I look out in the starry night, everything's mostly a void, and we come from a place where there isn't really that much, and if an extraterrestrial was to come here, he'd probably only have mild interests.
I'm not sure about the void, though. You know, they popped the old Hubble and looked at a dark spot in space, James, and it turned out where they saw thousands or more galaxies. And again, as I said last week, not stars, which all have billions of stars within a galaxy. They found thousands of galaxies that you can't even see with the naked eye.
Oh, yes. There's an interesting problem in astronomy, and that is that if the universe is infinite, and there's an infinite number of things out there, then the sky should be absolutely white, because no matter how far you go, you will find a star, and that will provide light for that area. And so it's a difficult kind of a thinking problem for astronomy. But be that as it may, we, as far as we can see, and every time we build a bigger telescope, there's something farther out, right?
Never ends.
So we clearly have not scratched the surface of discovery. And that's what somewhat bothers me about many modern astronomers, is that it makes, they make it sound like we know all about all of this. And frankly, I think we're just beginning to scratch the surface.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, James.
Yeah.
Hi. I have a question and I have an observation.
Okay.
My question, do you guys know about the Hutchison effect and the connection with Tesla? Have you studied any of that?
That doesn't ring a bell offhand.
Hutchison being, of course, John Hutchison?
Right. So you know about this?
Yes, I do.
Okay, I would suggest, you know, if possible, everybody look it up on Google. It's interesting reading. I saw an observation that I thought I would tell you about, and it happened the very night that the Mars lander crashed into Mars, to give you the date. There was a large object that entered the Earth, I guess the immediate upper atmosphere, about Mobile, Alabama, and it exited somewhere past Asheville, North Carolina.
What do you think it was?
That's pure speculation, but it was very large.
And you're saying it happened at the same time that one of the probes popped into Mars?
Those things I would say are disconnected as far as I know, but that gives you the date for verification purposes.
Hmm.
But the point of my observation would be that as this object passed over, it produced an enormous amount of electromagnetic energy.
Now, that's happened before, James. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie, James McKinney, my guest. James, the book, Atlantis to Tesla, so many people emailing me wanting to know where they can get it, if there's any special deals for Coast listeners. What do you got on the plate for us? Anything?
Well, the two-book set, of course, everything is available on my website individually or the combination, but what I've set up for the release tonight was the two-book set, the original book, which I want people to read, The Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, which gives the science that is necessary to understand the Atlantis to Tesla book.
And by the way, Lex has the link up to your book on the Coast to Coast AM website already, so he's quick.
And so anyway, the two-book set, which would normally be $38, including postage, I have an offer of $28. And that includes priority shipping to U.S. locations. And I have an 800 number. That's 800-289-2891. And also a mailing address.
Okay, let's give that number out again. 800-289-2891?
Right.
Okay. And what's the mailing address, James?
Is JMCC.
Mm-hmm.
P.O. Box 58, P.O. Box 58, Navarre is N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, M-N, 55392. So that's JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre is N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota is M-N, 55392, and the $28 will get you both books, including priority shipping.
Very good. Let's go to some calls. First time caller, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with James McKinney. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Lonnie from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Welcome, Lonnie.
Thank you. I'd like to ask James, is there any connection between the Tesla theories he's talking about and the Masonic idea of sacred geometry, and was Tesla a Mason?
Well, that I don't know. My understanding is Tesla was. I can't answer that about if he was a Mason or regarding the geometry. There's no real geometry here involved, other than you have an electrical device which alters the dielectric constant of the Earth's atmosphere in a vertical direction. And so it's not relative to any shape or geometry. It's quite a simple device once you understand how it works and the principles involved. In fact, there's many other ways to do this, which I do talk about in the book also. Tesla just found one way to do it. But I'm not aware of any relationship of, like you were mentioning there, between Masons or between sacred geometry.
Because some believe that that is indeed part of the secret societies that are out there.
There are many, many aspects to the secret societies, which include star dating and calendars and celestial numerology, many things which they use to predict or to plan activities, those types of things. So certainly, this is not a part of my study or my books, but that certainly does exist.
As a matter of fact, next week, James, I've got a guest on. His name is John Rappaport, and we are going to be talking about secret societies.
Oh, all right.
So all right. You have to listen in on that one as well.
Yes, absolutely.
How close are you to Minnesota, by the way?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Oh, that's where I am.
I mean, to Minneapolis.
Yes, I'm close. I'm right there.
So you can listen to us on KSDP.
Absolutely. Local station, and I know there are many people here listening.
Well, you know, I used to live there for about a year or so.
That's right. I know that, and I understand you were one of the, what, if not the youngest head of the major
at the time.
media in...
I can't use the word youngest anymore.
Me too.
Let's go back to the phones. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air. Hi there.
Good morning, George. Hi, James.
Yes.
This is John calling from Medford, Oregon, listening on AM 1440.
Sure thing. Welcome aboard, John.
Yeah. First-time caller also. Yeah, getting back to comets, I wasn't able to see Hale Bopp because of heavy cloud coverage, but I did get some wonderful views of Hyakutake. And I was wondering if James could expand a little bit on how big Hyakutake is in reference to Hale Bopp and when it may be coming around again.
Okay.
Okay, I don't know the period of Hyakutake, and I know there's numerous pronunciations of that, but it was a smaller comet. It was just nearer. And oddly enough, that was the one which ultimately they discovered X-rays, the guys over at Goddard there. And, of course, that's something I claim to have predicted in 1979 and 81 in my early papers. It's in the... In fact, the appendix of my first book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, reprints the article and points out the prediction of X-rays and comets. So to the sunward side of comets as part of the electron beam that comes out of the sun as part of the electrical discharge. And, of course, that's a whole other issue. But Hyakutake was a smaller comet. It was just near us. And it was a flash in the pan, so to speak, because it didn't last very long, whereas Hale Bopp was 6 years visible.
Wow.
To the naked eye.
Yeah. And that was in 96, I believe, that Hyakutake came.
Oh, all right, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Also, you guys were talking about Mount Weather in Virginia. From what I understand, that was built, it's apparently near the Pentagon, and apparently it can house like 50,000 people, and they have enough staples and whatnot to last for several years, from what I've heard, and mainly for nuclear shelters. Again, that's what I've heard. I don't know. But
it'll be back, by the way, in 8,000 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't
all
think
right.
We have to worry about that.
But that's...
yeah.
Oh, okay.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Okay. Of course, you might have to, James. You may live forever. You never know about you scientists.
We'll have to see about that.
Some of the things you concoct in a laboratory, eh? East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jeff from Quincy, Illinois, with an example for James of Carl Sagan's scientific incompetence. During Gulf War I, Sagan was on morning television predicting that there would be global catastrophic climactic results, remarkably similar to his nuclear winter, should Saddam Hussein torch the Kuwaiti oil fields.
Now, I recall that, by the way, Jeff, and in fact, he did torch them, and that did not happen, did it?
No, and nobody seemed to hold saintly Sagan to account for such a off-the-wall prediction, which seemed to be self-serving, because his nuclear winter seemed to be a justification for unilateral disarmament. And we don't really know scientifically, but he got away with that, and it got conveniently swept under the rug. So your prior remarks about him conducting a hatchet job on Velikovsky, I thought I should contribute that.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and that's a good observation. It's one of the things, and I might point out there is a good book by Charles Ginnenthal, one of the great Velikovsky historians, regarding, volumes of things that happened just like that but have been swept under the rug.
Of course, Sagan was a great astronomer in his day.
Yes, yes. Well, he held the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy at Cornell University for many years, of course.
This spacecraft that you've got in your book looks like a UFO, to tell you the truth.
That is the idea, yes. And when I presented that at the international conferences back in 82, there were some raised eyebrows, believe me.
Maybe that's their propulsion system?
Well, yeah, absolutely. There's no question about it. It describes the glowing ring and the current that comes over the skin of the spacecraft, the return current, which is part of the environment, is the glowing part of the outer portion of the visible spacecraft. So That's why they glow. That's why they it shows how they move relative to the magnetic field, their methods of motion, that type of thing.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hi there.
Good evening, George. Good evening, James.
Yes, sir.
This is Richard calling from Bozeman, Montana.
Sure.
James, in the mid-1970s, I was involved with a company called Project Private Enterprise. We were doing our own launch vehicle development, and one of the things that we had on board were some Tesla coils. We were splitting O2s into O1 singlets and using them to charge the launch vehicle and be able to interact with the ionosphere. We were successful. We were able to pull about 22 gravities at 500 feet, and as soon as we did this, which did not make the national media or anything, various national security agencies became involved, and we were quickly ostracized and shut down. Now, my question is, are you aware of any venues that might be available today whereby your technology or our variation of it could be developed outside of government control?
I do not know. I can't answer that. In fact, I get asked that question quite a bit, or asked if I can help find funding for various projects. I know I had a conversation once with a scientist, somewhat middle-aged, and he had worked for McDonnell Douglas back in the days before it was combined, or was split apart, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I had a conversation with him, and I was talking about what I had been doing back in the early 80s. And he stopped, and he said, "I can't believe you're telling me everything that we were working on back then."
My gosh.
And he worked on top-secret projects.
Well, I think there were several of us that were working on those things. And is it possible to communicate directly with you, James, at the P.O. Box 58?
Well, that's just an order line, unfortunately.
But how about an email, James? You got an
email? Go to the website, use an email, and hopefully it'll get through the thousands that just put asterisks and exclamation points or something. And hopefully, your name is...
Richard,
yeah, we'll just send an email, and if you don't hear back in a week, send another one.
Okay.
But because I get a lot, and they're screeners, and so
sure.
Just get through those guys. And
okay. I want to thank you very much. Thank you, George, for having James as a guest.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome indeed. By the way, I want to ask anybody who lives up in the Toronto area, if you know of a very small plane crash that might have occurred this morning, can you email me? I'm getting some very strange emails in on a plane that crashed with, and I'm not going to say who might have been aboard at this time, but if you're in Toronto and you know of a small plane crash that might have occurred in the last day or so, email me at george@coasttocoastam.com and just let me know if you think that may have occurred out there. It might be a bizarre story, and it might be a story that a lot of the national media might be talking about, and I have no idea if this is confirmed or not, and that's why I'm not going to say too much. Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, this is Michael from Indianapolis.
Hi there. Welcome.
How you guys doing tonight?
Good.
I just have a quick and simple connection that you two alluded to earlier in the program, and that is that all of the religions seem to take us back with the technology, and all the astronomy and astrology seem to really lead us back primarily to the caves. And that is an area I think we need to really dwell upon to find the answer to all these topics that we talk about tonight.
Could be.
That is my main comment.
Could very well be. All right, thanks for those comments. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Morning, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Stephen Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
George, I've been waiting for you to ask Richard Hoagland why we use parachutes in an atmosphere of Mars when there's no atmosphere to parachute.
Well, it's a drag type thing, but it's a little one.
And I'm sorry, I forgot your guest's first name.
This is James. James McCanny is the guest.
James, Bode's Law, does your field have, your electrical field explain Bode's Law, since regular science doesn't seem to be able to? And what kind of effect would this Wormwood asteroid coming into the, or comet coming into our solar system have on near-Earth asteroids that we're constantly spending so much money tracking. Will it scramble their flight path and no longer be predicted, or what?
No, okay. First of all, regarding Bode's Law, you're talking about the spacing of the planets?
Right. You double the distance of Mercury to find Venus, double the distance from Venus to the Sun to find the Earth, etc.
Right. But if you look at all of the examples, it doesn't hold very true. It held, on a very rudimentary basis, it holds. However, if you go out and you start looking at all the new planets they're finding, the minor planets, the Kuiper objects. But basically, to answer your question, capture of objects coming in very nicely explains the ordering of the solar system, because if you have two objects that are too closely related in orbit, they either begin orbiting each other or become involved in some type of interaction, and something has to happen. I mean, either one throws the other one out of the solar system or out of that region. And so the study of the capture phenomena is something that modern astronomers really have to take a look at, because it is the dominant method of formation of our solar system. It's very complicated. There's many ways to look at it. There's a statistical analysis that can be done. There are direct, like, computer simulations that can be done to give you a feel. There are literally observations that can be done. And so it's a very complicated area of astronomy that most astronomers don't know anything about. But also, as far as asteroids are concerned,
I ask that is because you keep referring to the Bible all night long, and it's not wormwood that hits us. It's an asteroid named Apollo that hits us. And then the Bible says we go through the red dragon's tail, and all of the waters are poison turned to wormwood, which sounds like a comet to me. So I was just curious.
The whole reference in the Bible to wormwood is referring to a comet. And a lot of times it's that ancient versus modern interpretation of what might be Apollo, as we look at it like a small Earth-crossing asteroid versus a big comet. It may be a matter of definition, like the Atlantic Ocean, the ancient interpretation versus the modern interpretation, or the Pillars of Hercules or whatever, you know.
James, I want to get out your toll-free phone number and your address one more time if people are interested in ordering the books. And again, you can get two for the price of?
$28. This is the first and the second book, A Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, plus the new book, the Atlantis to Tesla. This is $28, 800-289-2891.
And the address is JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, NAVARRE, Minnesota, 55392. James, next time, all right?
Thank you, George.
Always a pleasure. James McCanny. Dave Caprita, Dan Galanti for Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Barbara Simpson, and always Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. In the meantime, have a safe day, everyone.